Thanks for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com. I'm fortunate to have some sponsors supporting the show whose products I genuinely love and recommend. I'll start with a word on those so the rest of the episode will have no interruptions. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's O-U-R-A. The Aura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Aura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Aura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Aura Ring on AuraRing.com. That's O-U-R-A-R-I-N-G.com. AuraRing.com. This episode is brought to you by Levels. Levels uses continuous glucose monitoring to track your blood sugar in real time. It allows me to see the impact that everything I do has on my metabolic health so that I can optimize my diet and exercise accordingly. Wearing the Levels patch, I feel like I'm living in the future. There's this moment when you raise your phone to the back of your arm, it vibrates and shows your glucose level right on the screen. It's this instantaneous look inside yourself, an in-the-moment snapshot of what's going on inside your body. And while it's only showing one simple measurement for now, it's enough for me to see the future. And that's exciting. It's exciting because I believe that we can live meaningfully longer and healthier lives than we do today, and I believe technologies like Levels will help us to get there. Levels is currently running an exclusive beta program with a waitlist of over 100,000 people, but you can skip the line and join Levels today by using my link in the show notes, levels.link/Jake. Again, that's levels.link/Jake. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you, Eric, for taking the time and joining me on the show today. I really appreciate it. Really interesting way that this episode came to be, actually. I put a tweet on an early story. I was listening to a podcast with, I guess it was originally sort of a stage talk with Tyler Cowen and Peter Thiel. And at the end, this guy asked a question about basically he was trying to start a new city and a new form of governance and see if he could make a positive difference in the world. And afterwards, he said his name is Eric Brimmon. And I sort of recognized the name, and I had heard of the project that you're the founder and CEO of, a company called Prospera. I'd heard of it and been following for some time, and I guess I had seen your name here and there. And so I recognized it and went and looked it up. And sure enough, here you were several years after that talk, actually building the thing that you were talking about. So I thought that that was really cool. And you saw my tweet on this, and we were able to make this happen today. So really happy to have you. And it would be great if you could start by just sort of telling your story from as early as you're willing to start to where you are today and some of the decisions you made along the way.
Absolutely, Jake. Thank you very much for having me. So my story that leads me to Prospera starts with having been born in the country of Venezuela in Latin America. You know, a country that today is one of the poorest countries in the region, but in the past was one of the most prosperous, actually, and thanks to its vast natural resources, oil particularly. By the time I was growing up, you know, around 9-10 years old, and I was becoming more and more aware of my surroundings, it was unavoidable to realize that there was a big disparity between few people in that society with in relative terms abundant wealth and the majority of people, which in relative terms were rather poor. And my mother raised me to be aware of this and, you know, try to do something about it, not just to be, to ignore it, but to be grateful for the position that we were in, and also to seek to do something about it, not just to be passive. And to be candid, I sort of grew up a bit with more of the altruistic mental model of it's important to eventually give back to society, and I aspired to it someday. At some point in my life, I imagined, you know, towards retirement age or what have you, I would have the extra bandwidth and wealth to just, quote unquote, go back home and, you know, make a difference and give back. But then I left the country, largely because of Chavez taking over and a lot of political turmoil leading to lack of security and lack of opportunities. And I left and I did a military academy high school in the US. And then I was fortunate to go to Babson College in Boston. And throughout those 8 years of studying, what was happening is in my country, things were getting worse, despite the fact that Chavez had taken the reins and claimed to be leading the nation towards greater prosperity and was taking drastic measures to do so. And in the beginning, I and many people thought that it was about time somebody did something about all those people that were on the bottom, say 70% and below the poverty line. That was not working at all. It was actually getting worse. And on the other side, I was learning about entrepreneurship while at Babson, in parallel to having started a couple of small businesses initially as part of my college career. It was a requirement at Babson. And I was experiencing firsthand what it looks like to actually start a business and serve your customers, while at the same time, I was learning the theory of it in the classroom. And I was realizing the power of market forces, competition, and the profit motive to drive human behavior in service of your select customer base. And I was interpreting it not religiously per se, but perhaps in a more profound way. I was interpreting it being in business as choosing a life of service, quite literally, where your customers are your reason for existing and where you wake up every day to service them voluntarily. And so that was the background. And yet I was looking at my country of birth and things were going in the wrong direction. Government seemed to be saying all the right things, that the leader had all the powers that he needed. And things weren't getting better. And honestly, I asked a lot of my professors and I said, look, how come we have a private sector and a public sector? Like, why that division? Everything that you all are teaching me that works is in the private sector, generally speaking. And then you got the public sector, which, depending on the country, is heavily politicized corruption. Like, why the both? Why the two? And the answer I got was something along the lines of, well, you need a public institution to balance out what would otherwise be the abuse of greedy business owners, something along those lines. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying. That was one answer. Then the other answer was that government provides very valuable services, such as security and rule of law and justice, et cetera. And now the latter part of it made a lot of sense to me. You can't have a market economy without a system that everybody follows, and it's kind of same rules for everybody, meritocracy ideally. But the first one didn't make any sense, because by then I had been trying to serve a customer segment that I had chosen in my small business, and I knew there was no real way for me to abuse them, so to speak. I mean, maybe I could get away with it once, by selling them some crappy product and getting more money than it was fair, but I wouldn't be able to do that sustainably. In fact, I was working really hard, almost begging that they would part ways with their hard-earned money to buy the products I was selling, which at the time revolved around golfing products, golf products. But that did not make sense. And I started challenging a lot of these mental models and premises. And to make a long story short, I realized that there was a big gap and opportunity to develop a system by which market forces could be injected into and directed to solve the most pressing social needs of society, which is what government supposedly is there to do, but with the wrong incentive structure generally. And so I embarked upon what at the time was mostly an academic exercise of thinking through how could you possibly direct the best of what free market enterprises, the profit motive, and competition create in human interactions to actually solve directly, not indirectly as an externality, but directly some of these core needs that every civilized society seems to have figured out. And generally speaking, it's rule of law and the individual freedom. And I'm going down that path. I started looking at poverty not as poverty per se, but the absence of prosperity and the problem to solve being not how you get rid of poverty, but actually how you catalyze prosperity. And it all came together because the answer to how you catalyze prosperity, as empirically demonstrated, is by having institutions of good governance where people can generally be free as long as they don't hurt others, with the assurance that their property is theirs and protected, that they're safe from coercion, fraud, and abuse. And that once you have that and people have to deal with each other only through voluntary means, then people are amazing. They figure things out. And it doesn't matter where in history and what part of the world, including cultures, once you have those basic conditions, then within a generation or two, unimaginable prosperity emerges. And you saw that in Singapore and Hong Kong, Dubai, many different places. So short version of it is, well, heck, if you want to get rid of poverty, you got to catalyze prosperity. If you want to catalyze prosperity, you got to create these institutions of good governance. And any institution that is proven to have worked has the right incentive structure. And nothing has been more powerful than for-profit organizations at solving problems. So what if you create a type of organization that is, quote unquote, in the business of creating institutions of good governance for profit? And that's long story where the vision of Prospera comes from. And that's exactly what we're doing now in partnership with governments around the world.
That's a great story and I appreciate you sharing. I think it's really interesting what you said about, looking at poverty in sort of, with sort of a different framework. You mentioned like growing up having more of this like altruistic idea, like maybe I'll make a lot of money and then one day be able to donate maybe to some nonprofits and maybe make the world a little bit of a better place that way. And then realizing through your education and experience in business that maybe sort of redistribution to eliminate poverty isn't really the right way to go about it. That sort of assumes that wealth is like a given, but wealth has to be sort of made and earned, and prosperity, like you said, needs to be catalyzed. And so, if you focus on that side of things, maybe that'll sort of fix the poverty in a way, just by creating more wealth and more abundance overall, and better sort of frameworks and perhaps cities and even countries for people to, go to, like the old version of an American dream or whatever. You come from wherever you come from, and you come to America and you work hard and you have reasonable confidence that you'll be able to, buy a house and raise a family and have that family be well fed and educated and have healthcare and all of these sort of standards of life that we come to sort of take for granted sometimes in the developed world, but certainly not everyone has. So you went and you sort of figured out after an early career mostly focused in finance and probably learning more about business and how you could actually go about sort of logistically trying to do something like this when you were ready to go out and do your own entrepreneurial thing. You finally decided it's time to start Prospera, and you identified Honduras as the sort of ideal partner in terms of a country to go and build this first project. So can you introduce what Prospera is for those who have never heard of it, and maybe a brief history and where it's gotten to today.
Definitely, Jake. And let me first say that before I started Prosper, I actually started a New Way Capital, which, given my finance background, it was set up as a venture capital fund of sorts, looking to invest in projects such as what Prosper is now doing in Honduras. But others had been talking about for a long time. My vision was to focus on what I at the time felt I was best at, which was on finance. And help direct resources, shape business plans, and then support other entrepreneurs in building these enterprise cities, is what we were calling them at the time, in a partnership I signed with Babson College. But in essence, a city is being created from scratch with an alternative regulatory and legal system from that of the host country. And said system designed to be optimal for entrepreneurship and new business creation. So I started New Way Capital. In fact, I'm still wearing my New Way Capital hat. I'm still the CEO of New Way Capital. And a lot of my answers will be based from that vantage point. But Prospera, what is Prospera? Prospera is what we would consider a socioeconomic development business, where by its business plan design makes money in proportion to how it creates conditions for generalized prosperity to emerge. And in more simple terms, basically, we partner with governments to create new cities from scratch, where the key differentiator is not just better infrastructure in the physical realm, but actually better institutions that are in place to provide and guarantee good governance. And what does that mean? Well, I mean, good governance generally comes from three key pillars. You've got to have good rules and the administration thereof. And generally speaking, common law is the best system out there if you consider economic prosperity as an indicator of which system works best. And in common law, private property and individual rights reigns supreme, right? There isn't the collective interest over that of the individual. It's the other way around. It's the individual that reigns supreme as sovereign, and then the property of said individuals, it's considered an extension of self, and therefore it's theirs to decide upon. So good rules and the administration thereof. Two is the effective and efficient adjudication of justice, so dispute resolution. If, as it's inevitable, parties end up having a disagreement, how do they resolve their problem? And that in our system is mostly arbitration, but basically justice is a key component of good governance. And last but not least is safety. And essentially, you know, having the institutions in place to ensure that individuals cannot be overpowered through force, whether it's physical force or fraud, by other individuals or group of individuals, gangs and or organized crime or mobsters. And so you got to have security in place. And so Prospera partners with governments to create within the limited and relatively small compared to the overall country, these cities that run on best-in-class governance services. And the way Prospera makes money is by having important investments in the realm of real estate, which appreciates in value in proportion to the economic activity that takes place upon said real estate. Two, by making strategic investments in either first-mover companies, core infrastructure, or businesses generally that are positioned to benefit substantially from the better regulatory and legal environment that Prosper provides. And you know, this is modeled after the Temasek Fund in Singapore. And then last but not least, and I would argue most fundamentally innovative, is in governance as a service. And basically we look at what governments do as a service. We think of it as they charge a fee, which is the taxes that they collect, and which in aggregate tends to be north of 40% of all income. Once you add up all taxes, the global standard ranges between 35 to 45%, which is really expensive if you think about it. I mean, of every dollar people make, they pay about 40% of their income for services that governments provide. It's a lot. In fact, it's the largest industry in the world with over $30 trillion a year in revenues. And we think of it as you would any other industry. And we say, well, how can we do that better and cheaper? And can we make money out of it? And the answer in our model is yes. If you know, you apply technology, you use business sense, you can consistently deliver better service at substantially less cost and still make a profit. So the third and most important pillar is governance as a service. We're currently operating in Honduras, or Prosper is currently operating in Honduras, and New Way Capital is prospecting in a number of other places around the world, which is still too early to disclose publicly. But there is at least one signed MOU and very proactive work with another nation state to create the legal conditions on the ground through which to establish a prosperous city and then deliver the same service to them.
Yeah, so it's interesting you talk about the business model. There's the land appreciation, of course, if you can make more valuable things and happen on top of the land and have people there and buildings there, the land appreciates in value and you can either, you know, rent it out or sell it and realize some profit that way. Then you mentioned sort of this investing in some of the companies, I think it sounds like, that are, you know, coming to fruition on top of the land, or I understand you guys also have sort of like an E residence or yeah, e-residence program basically to, you know, where companies can incorporate there without having to be there physically. So maybe that's involved. And then lastly, you mentioned you know, like the taxation structure and government services basically being the service that you're providing. I want to double click on the second one real quick because you mentioned like this Temasek model that was executed well in Singapore. Can you explain a little bit what that is and how Prospera seeks to sort of follow that model in your own project?
Sure. So before I talk about the Temasek model, generally speaking, countries or cities tend to have, and in the US, states have like an economic promotion agency of sorts. And what those agencies seek to do is come up with a series of incentives and sometimes outright investments, though, since they're governmental or quasi-governmental, it tend to be grants to stimulate businesses to come into their jurisdiction. And in their mind, the idea is, okay, if you convince them to come here, even if you do tax credits or outright grants, the value of their economic activity will exceed the cost of bringing them here. The difference between that and a for-profit approach, of which Singapore, I would argue also Israel, were the pioneers from a nation-state perspective, is that those investments are still made available, but they're made as private and for-profit investments. So nowadays, Temasek is one of the largest. They don't consider it a sovereign wealth fund, but in essence, it is. But you think of it as a private equity slash venture capital fund, multi-billion dollar in size. And the holdings within it started out by making investments in companies that were essential to develop the Singapore economy, whether they were infrastructure in nature, like the access, transportation system. They call it mass access versus public because it is private, or even financial institutions and all sorts of entities. So within Prospera, as a startup jurisdiction before it becomes a city, we have a similar dynamic. There are certain types of businesses and services that are more essential than others. For example, education, healthcare, infrastructure that need to be in place. Now, as a jurisdiction or as a developer of a city, you could think you have two options. You can either do it yourself, or you can incentivize third parties to do it within the jurisdiction. And because the jurisdiction in the early days doesn't have internal market demand, and in our case, there isn't a large enough population around where we're building to be the demand source, then you have to essentially build a bridge for these for-profit enterprises. And that's where making an early stage investment very selectively can make sense. And when we make those investments, we and the companies receiving the capital are betting on the fact that over time, because from their perspective, not just the money, but the conditions that are available to them, they will grow faster and ultimately generate more profit, even though they're giving up some of their equity. And from our perspective, obviously, the direct return on the investment, has to clear a risk reward hurdle, but also the indirect benefits of having, let's say, top class education within our jurisdiction, more than pays for itself through indirect sources of wealth creation. For instance, the fact that now residents want to move in to be close to the world-class school, which then means our real estate appreciates faster than otherwise would. So that's the Temasek equivalent. In our case, it's Prosper Capital.
Yeah, it's a super interesting model, and obviously, like the upside of all of this just seems pretty boundless. If over the however long it takes, this whole thing ends up succeeding, and you do build, a great and prosperous city in Honduras on Roatan or elsewhere in the world potentially in the future. When you mentioned you were sort of prospecting a bunch of different countries. Through Nuway and maybe Prospera as well, or Prospera as well. When you originally chose to partner with Honduras and strike a deal with the government there, basically, you have to sort of have a government that's somewhat open-minded and forward-leaning in order to even have this opportunity that Prospera now has in order to experiment with different things and how can we make governance better in a private way and things like this. And so it seems that you identified Honduras as like the best opportunity, or at the very least one of the best opportunities in the world to do that. Why was that? What made Honduras a standout choice for you guys when you first selected it, and how has that sort of proven out in the first few years so far?
Well, indeed, Jake, one of the most important considerations is whether or not the partnering country, the host country, has or is willing to develop the necessary legal infrastructure so that this type of large-scale development project can take place. From Nuwa's perspective, we looked at a number of countries throughout the world, and at the time, the most advanced one in this domain of having enhanced special economic zone legislation, in essence, was Honduras. Yes, the government and the leaders, which are sometimes not governmental in nature, need to be forward-thinking. What we have seen works best is, developing countries or countries that are very aggressively seeking to attract foreign direct investment, so that they got a big carrot. They have something big and valuable to go after. And the reality is that in most places, it's extremely hard, if not impossible, where you have a democracy to make transformative reforms at a national level. Thus, instituting transformative policies that are proven to work elsewhere, but that the whole country might not be ready to accept at once in a subnational jurisdiction like an enhanced special economic zone, makes a lot more sense. So that's basically, as we're discussing with other nations, if they are in pursuit of substantially increased foreign direct investment, substantial increase in number of local job creation, and perhaps even substantially more innovation within their national boundaries so that they can not just be low-cost labor providers, but actually competitors in various emerging industries, then our value proposition is, well, look, we've been there, we've done it. The key distinction tends to be the legal framework, and then alongside with that, a series of aligned service providers and capital providers that understand the model, believe in the vision of unlimited human potential under the right conditions, and we can provide it almost like a turnkey solution where we don't do everything ourselves, but we bring the network of solutions, technologies, even capital, so that the vision can go from idea to fully realized 100,000 plus population centers where the generalized prosperity is unimaginable compared to what would have been expected prior. And globally, the vision is a network of interconnected cities that share this core backbone of good governance that, as I mentioned earlier, see the individual and the entrepreneurial forces as the most valuable thing to protect in civilized society. And so you share the same standards, even some service providers, to make sure there are economies of scale. And with an increasingly technologically interconnected world, the fact that you might have cities in Africa, Europe, Latin America, North America, sharing the same backbone of services is increasingly possible, and we're demonstrating it.
And what about outside of like the legislation and the government itself? What about Honduras in terms of whether it's geography or the people or the island itself of Roatan that the first hub is being built on? What were some of like the natural aspects to the country or the population that made it attractive in addition to the openness from government to try something like this, sort of comparable to a special economic zone?
Yeah, thanks for asking. There's a number of them, and Honduras is so fortunate and privileged in so many ways. Its geographic location is one of them. The fact that it's right smack in the middle of Central America, which is in the center of North and South America, with so much north-south, south-north commerce, is key. And it's similar to the advantageous position that Singapore had back in the day as a port, given the geographic location. But beyond that, generally speaking, Honduras has a fairly homogeneous population, and one of the highest rates of bilingual education in Latin America. It's a country where I believe it's the highest, but if not the highest, one of the highest English-speaking population per capita. And that goes back historically to the fact that American companies invested heavily, and they invested in education, and so there's a legacy of bilingual education from K through 12, and that is of tremendous value, and you're seeking to participate in international commerce. Beyond that, there is a very unique phenomenon to where we have started and why we chose where in Honduras to begin, which is Roatán, one of the Bay Islands of Honduras, which used to be a British colony. They speak predominantly English in Roatán. The US dollar is the currency of preference because it's an economy that runs primarily on tourism. It's beautiful. And interestingly enough, it's 1 square mile larger than the island of Hong Kong. So beyond just the geographical similarity in size, there's a bunch of ways in which Roatán is very similar in its potential to where Hong Kong was, say, 110 years ago. So we see Roatán as a potential future Hong Kong for the region. And thus we have our first hub there. And our second hub is on the mainland, just across the water at north of 40 some miles of distance. So not that far east of La Ceiba, which is a much larger city. It used to be the primary industrial city of the country, but then due to a number of unfortunate facts, including transnational criminal organizations taking over before they were combated out, it's sort of falling down ever lower compared to the other main cities, and today is a distant third. But there's tremendous interest there and sort of coming back stronger than ever. And we see that as the potential future Shenzhen for the region, you know, having a similar dynamic between Roatán and La Ceiba to what Hong Kong and Shenzhen had in its early days. Principally being that Roatán is positioned to serve as a platform through which international capital and talent can help develop much more rapidly than otherwise would happen. The northern corridor of Honduras, of which La Ceiba is the primary hub, and of which our Prospera hub being developed there is positioned to cater primarily to nearshoring opportunities right now. American companies, European companies looking to get much closer to the main consumption centers in the US and Canada and Brazil and Argentina and other countries in Latin America, but where they want to have a rule of law environment, where they want to have familiar laws, and where they know that if they make a big investment, they have a high degree of expectation and trust for how things are going to be handled since we're running on international common law.
Yeah, it's really interesting the parallels between Hong Kong and Shenzhen that you mentioned versus Roatán and La Ceiba, and you mentioned other countries that have sort of been inspiring to your mission: Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai, Shenzhen, of course. And so, and you look at these pictures. I don't know if you, I mean, I'm sure you've seen them. I don't know if people listening have seen them, but there's pictures of Hong Kong, Dubai, all of these places, you know, a few decades ago, and then today, or you know, in recent past. And you just look at the skyline and you sort of don't really need any other information to see how much these countries and or cities have gone from sort of nothing to these metropolises of sort of modern business and technology and civilization overall and just prosperity. And so obviously that's sort of like part of the long-term goal. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about all of this to me is that not only can you go and create this prosperous bit of land in Honduras and elsewhere, but you can then have this model, which if it proves to work, other larger countries or cities can look at it and start to incorporate some of the innovations into their societies. And so the impact can actually be much larger than having to build all of these places from scratch, which of course in and of itself is huge, but you can sort of change the way that governance works around the world. If some of these projects prove super successful, and already I think you're seeing that from, you know, for example, Hong Kong and Shenzhen in China, informing how they've made some changes to how China works and things like this. So how do you think about like the long term of, you know, you guys will go out and with Prospera, you'll build these places, whether it's in Honduras or elsewhere. Is that a part of your consideration? You know, what impact you might be able to have on other, you know, external to the organization cities and countries around the world that might seek to adopt some of these innovations that you're employing?
Absolutely. In fact, we're already starting to see it in this short amount of time, in relative terms. The fact that the Prospera hubs can adopt more innovative and forward-leaning policies don't just benefit the Prosper Hub, they demonstrate how these policies actually work, quote unquote, on site with the local population. And once they are adopted and demonstrated to succeed on a relatively small scale, it becomes infinitely easier to roll them out to larger scale, whether it is national outright or whether the neighboring city says, well, gee, that worked well. I want to replicate that. And within their jurisdiction, they get as close to the policies they see working as possible. So that is sort of influenced through positive example. But also, and let's face it, there's no more powerful force to drive human behavior than competition. And so as the nation states or nearby cities see that the hubs are working very well and they're attracting a lot of new foreign direct investment, you know, it's hard to see that happening nearby and not do something about it to catch some of that opportunity. So, you know, that's motivation through an opportunity that wasn't there before. So, but by absolutely, I think that it's hard, of course, to predict exactly how that positive externality shapes out and in what period of time, but it is unquestionable that that has happened. You know, so when you see Singapore to Malaysia, for example, or you see Dubai to the other Emirates, it's historically is proven that it has a positive spillover effect, and it's already starting to happen even in Honduras. You know, not the initial reaction is not always positive because it's also human behavior to say get jealous about the success of others that you might not have immediate access to. But over time, you know, that evolves into, I think, constructive behavior. So initially, right now, in Honduras, or at least in the short term, we've seen a bit of, let's say, the ugly underbelly of some of that maybe jealousy feeling. But it's starting to quickly shift to saying, well, okay, but it does work. And why don't we just adopt it? You know, if it is working, why don't we just adopt it? In the beginning, it was hypothetical. Now they're seeing the actual tangible results. And so other economic groups of the country quite literally are copying what we're doing. I mean, in some cases, literally copying the statutes, the charter, the regulatory frameworks. And we think it's great in a way. The competition is not really Honduras per se. It's quote unquote the rest of the world. It's antiquated, old and prescriptive approaches to regulating commerce that don't add any value, destroy prosperity. And so the more Honduras and nearby countries that they jump on board and share a similar approach to creating the best conditions, the better. And that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. The better Honduras is doing, in part because they adopt similar policies, the better we're going to do because we are part of Honduras and we're operating within the national territory of the country.
Right. So you guys have done some interesting things with crypto as well, and Bitcoin in particular, I believe. Like you very much view that, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but it's sort of like a, you know, an aligned movement with the one that you guys are on. Was it, you know, growing up in Venezuela, maybe sort of witnessing some hyperinflation and just how centralized money was problematic there, as it is, you know, many other places around the world, especially developing countries. Can you tell a little bit of the story of like, and first of all, like sort of clarify the involvement? Like I saw something, you know, Bitcoin might be the legal tender in these zones, but I'm not exactly sure of the specifics. So if you could sort of lay the specifics out and then talk about how crypto and, you know, building better cities with better governance sort of came to be, you know, aligned missions in a way that you felt were relevant and worth implementing.
Sure. So let me first give you the facts of what Prospera Zeta, which is the underlying jurisdiction, has done vis-a-vis certain cryptocurrencies, of which Bitcoin is the main one. In essence, what the jurisdiction did through its council, it recognizes Bitcoin as money versus a commodity. And what that means is it's not taxed on capital gains, and it is accepted. It's in fact, it's mandatory on the jurisdiction to accept it as a currency for payment of any obligations towards the jurisdiction, for instance, taxes. Okay. The jurisdiction doesn't mandate it and cannot define it as quote unquote legal tender for Honduras, but within the jurisdiction of Prospero Zelle, it is effectively considered money. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, USDC and Ether, for example. Now, why? Well, and what is the overlap? The one of the main sources of lack of innovation, to say it in the most positive way possible, in the way governance services are provided and the way governance providers operate governments, is the fact that there's centralized power. And in centralization of power, there is a lot more possibility for corruption, but also there's a lot more lost opportunity for agility and innovation. We've seen this communism versus capitalism. The value of decentralization is hardly overstated. Naturally, that's true for governance institutions, but it's also true for financial institutions. And chief amongst the pillars of finance is money itself, where fiat money obviously has had some value, but largely it's lost most of its purchasing power, like over 90% in the US dollar, at least in about 100 years, which is crazy. And then it has a series of other challenges to go along with it, not the least of which is the way in which the power to regulate can be misused through the control of the money system. So we, as in Prospero Zelle, believe that decentralization and maximum freedom, always in the context of operating legally, lawfully, not so we do believe highly in anti-money laundering standards in some ways. And of course, we would never support nefarious activities, whether it's fraud or just terrorism or any of those things. But short of those very specific and limited spheres, we think that maximum freedom works best. And one of the ways in which we can do that is by having the most decentralized financial system so far ever created in the history of mankind, which is Bitcoin itself as not just money, but as a financial system all in one. And indeed, most of the people that are early movers in crypto share similar values. And so we find that we can speak the same language, so to speak, quite easily, and they instantly get what we're about and what we're seeking to do. And that helps a lot, especially with one of my primary focuses and one of the key strategic pillars for how Prospera is building this vision of the future. Which is by activating and bringing co-creators on board. And so if we speak the same language philosophically, it's always easier to get people to jump on board and pursue their own self-interest, but in a manner that's aligned and complementary to the Prosper vision.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think there's good reason why a lot of people who are interested in crypto, which I think right now is sort of the larger of the two sort of areas of interest between crypto and more of like startup cities type of things. I think there's a reason why a much higher percentage, at least this is sort of my anecdotal feel, but a much larger percentage of if you find someone who's like very much into crypto, they're much more often inclined to be interested in these startup city type of projects versus just sort of picking a random person off of the street because a lot of the values I think are very aligned and it's a lot about sovereignty and just creating, how can we create better systems than the ones that have been going on for generations? And I think there's a lot of, I'm certainly interested in both spaces and others alike. So it'll be interesting to see how they all sort of pair together and work together in the years to come. When you think about Prospera and say I'm gonna go and I'm gonna visit your guys' slice of the land and in Roatan in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, whatever sort of the best timeline is for you that you sort of think of as like a North Star, next, big great objective, but in like sort of relative long term. And I say relative long term, I mean it's long term for a company maybe, but cities presumably take quite a while longer. I'm curious, like if you could paint a picture of sort of I go and I fly there and I walk around like what's around me? Like, what am I seeing? I know you guys have a couple of buildings up already. And of course, an office where You and presumably, basically everyone who's working for the company works. But what's that going to be like in, 10, 15 years, whatever the timeline is?
Sure. Well, let me talk about Roatan primarily because it's our first hub, and what I perceive best, given how things are already evolving. But I think within 10 to 15 years, you land on Roatan through the international airport, and you go straight to the Prosper Hub. And what you see as you walk around is a Caribbean version of Victoria Harbor in Hong Kong. So you will see much higher density architecture and development, meaning taller buildings than you would normally expect in an underdeveloped island, but totally expect in a modern city, in part because it's much more environmentally friendly, but because it maximizes human-to-human collisions, innovation, and thus economic activity. When I say a Caribbean version of it, I mean in part that the integration with nature is perhaps a lot more obvious and purposeful than was back in its day in Hong Kong when Victoria Harbor was developed. But very importantly, the sense of technological progress and innovation is palpable. You see buildings that look modern. You then realize that they have been constructed following innovative technologies with advanced materials. And so they have shapes and structures that just don't seem possible, or at least you're not used to seeing elsewhere. But here, they're not only possible, they're the norm because it is more efficient, it is more economically viable, and more utilitarian to do things with advanced technology. Of course, it continues to be a beautiful place where living a healthy life with outdoors activity at your fingerprints is very much part of your everyday life as a possibility. You're surrounded by people that just seem to be happy and purposeful, and they just have that jump in their walk of being in pursuit of something that is inspiring to them. And that doesn't mean they're all in finance. In fact, you have people of all walks of life, of all economic standards, and of all industries. You have the artist that's just inspired in making beautiful sculptures and paintings, and they've carved a niche for themselves. But then you also have, the very advanced scientists working on pioneering ways to ensure human life is as extendable as possible in the best of the quality of living that people want. And obviously you have, crypto finance and manufacturing and, all these industries being led by people that are just on this world to pursue their passion, and somehow they've arrived here knowing that this is the place that celebrates them as heroes of society, which they are, as they pursue value for value exchanges. Beyond Prosper and Roatan, however, and the specific jurisdiction, the footprint, which by then would likely be much larger. I think you zoom out and you see an island that is far more prosperous than every other island in the Caribbean, and where the distribution of wealth is one that you would associate with a very developed country. Low Gini coefficient, meaning there's fair distribution of wealth. You don't have a big small big a low income population and a small high income population, because everybody generally has access to opportunities. And this is just one hub, because by then the hub by La Ceiba is also flourishing. It's mostly modern industrial with mixed use residential, and we have thousands of people living what appears to be a very fulfilled life as well, though their jobs are different than those on the island. And when you arrive here, you learn about a network of interconnected Prosper hubs throughout the world, which, as a resident of any one of the hubs, you automatically have legal access to any hub around the world, knowing that any one of them will give you the same high standard of government and governance services. I could go on, but let me pause there for now.
Oh yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it's an awesome vision and an inspiring mission. And obviously, like I said at the top of the episode, you've been thinking about all of this for years and years and years. And I can imagine it's quite exciting to finally be sort of executing on some of the early stages where you start to see buildings coming out of the ground, and I'm sure the hard work only gets harder, but it's cool to see some of this stuff come to fruition, and I can only imagine 10 years, 15 years from now, like you said, how much better it's all going to be, and looking forward to visiting one day myself. I know we're coming up on time. I would love to talk more about all of this, but we'll stop there for now. Where can people who are inspired by this vision and want to see if they can get involved some way, whether it's just by the internet, maybe they can start getting involved with the community a little bit, or maybe they can actually consider relocating, if not now, someday soon, or even in the long term future. How best for how, what's the best way for people to go and follow along what you guys are doing and hopefully get involved at some point now or in the future?
Sure. Well, an easy one would be Twitter. You can go to Prospera Global to follow Prospera in its English version, and then Prospera.hn in its Spanish version. You can DM me as well. My DM is still open. I'm Eric Bremen, so at Eric Bremen in Twitter. And then if you are interested as a potential co-creator, you should definitely go to the website as well, prospera.hn, and click through to get information as a potential business customer of the jurisdiction. And our onboarding team will reach out to you, and then we can guide you through whatever funnel makes most sense for your stage of development, your industry, and what it is you're looking to do.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Erica. I really appreciate you coming on and taking the time today. And very excited and have been for a while, but only more so now about what you guys are building now that progress is really showing. And looking forward to seeing again what that 10-year vision when it actually gets built out. Hopefully, I can visit at some point, but all sounds super exciting. And hopefully, other people agree and get involved. And yeah, thank you again and looking forward to seeing what's next.
Thanks a lot, Jake. Appreciate it.